Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
As the new Florida governor prepares to take office, a big question is, what kind of economy will he be inheriting from his predecessor? And what will that make possible for the new administration?
And I think we need to get to a point where we're looking at smart infrastructure in the state of Florida.
Also this week, it was the first ever meeting for Governor-elect Ron DeSantis's environmental transition team, but when the words climate change weren't even mentioned, advocates for environmental protection took action.
The letter really just asks Governor-elect DeSantis to acknowledge that climate change is a serious threat.
We'll also talk about how an ongoing FBI probe of Tallahassee city government might have meant defeat for mayor-turned-gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis's economic transition team held a conference call this week to pitch suggestions on how to harness what will drive Florida's economy going forward. We get that story from Ryan Daly.
Wi-Fi signal on highways, statewide 5G cell phone service, and, quote, smart cities friendly to automated vehicles, all that and more could be the future of Florida's economy. At least that's according to those advising DeSantis on the subject.
And I think we need to get to a point where we're looking at smart infrastructure in the state of Florida.
Ananth Prasad is former secretary of Florida's Department of Transportation and president-designate of the Florida Transportation Builders Association. He describes smart infrastructure as a system where automated cars can communicate with the infrastructure around them, as well as other self-driving vehicles. To Prasad, the technology represents an opportunity to increase safety.
If you think about the fatalities on the state roads in the state of Florida, you can eliminate 80% of those fatalities are because of driver error.
Joe York is president of AT&T Florida. He explained a bit about what 5G wireless service is and how it will make commerce move.
It is significantly faster. You're talking about speeds that are similar to what you would get from a fiber-based product, potentially as fast as gigabit speeds wirelessly.
York says 5G will be expanding through the state starting in the coming year. He adds achieving a true smart state will depend largely on how much his industry is involved.
Florida is going to be a 5G state, that we're going to have ubiquitous coverage, that we're going to be a smart state. All those things have to come within encouraging the investor, i.e. the wireless companies and the cable companies, to continue investing their dollars. They know that they're going to be able to get a return on that.
And the hunger for omnipresent internet connection extends to the state's highways. Current Department of Transportation head Mike Dew says drivers could have Wi-Fi every time they hit the road.
We know that whether you're a visitor or a native Floridian, that you get your information through cellular, through wireless, it's critical. And we work with our partners in that space every single day, and we have to continue to do so. It's going to be absolutely critical in the future.
Not everything discussed by the economic transition team centered on futuristic technology. The group has interest in strengthening Florida's ports, something championed by outgoing Governor Rick Scott. Dew says when working in government, not every investment pays off, but he insists investing in ports is a sure thing.
The investments in airports, seaports, rail, roads, bridges, it's undeniable.
Eric Green, CEO of the Jacksonville Port Authority, backed that up in relation to seaports using some data.
No, the Florida ports have generated approximately about 13% of the state GDP and support 900,000 jobs, which generate about $4.3 billion in tax revenue.
Green says Florida's seaports have an edge against their domestic competitors.
Florida is the only state in the country with seaports on two vital U.S. water shipping lines at the Atlantic and the Gulf.
Governor-elect Ron DeSantis also this week tapped a new leader for the State Department of Economic Opportunity, choosing current Visit Florida CEO Ken Lawson. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
After a year that saw an explosion of toxic algae blooms in Florida and a host of other environmental concerns, it's no surprise that the state's incoming governor would like all the information he can get in advance of leading the state. This week was the first meeting of Governor-elect DeSantis' environmental transition team, but as we hear from Blaise Gainey, a number of environmental advocates were not exactly thrilled with the outcome.
Prior to winning the governor's race, Ron DeSantis promised to restore the Everglades and preserve the state's beaches. On December 10th, his environmental transition team met for the first time to discuss water quality and supply. The main focus, Everglades restoration after red tide caused a state of emergency in seven counties. Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Noah Valenstein says one plan is building water storage pools to keep contaminated water separate.
The main drivers of Everglades restoration are large storage and conveyance features to restore the Everglades. And so on the East Coast, you have the C-44 Reservoir.
That reservoir is paid for by the state and federal government. And the one on the West Coast, the C-43 Reservoir, is fully funded by the state. Valenstein says the reservoirs will create a lot of space for storage water.
Combined, these two reservoirs will provide more than 40 billion gallons of storage, as well as treatment components, to protect our estuaries.
But the West Coast Reservoir won't be done until 2022, and others may take longer. Meanwhile, Aliki Moncrief, executive director of Florida Conservation Voters, delivered a letter with more than 3,000 signatures to the governor's office.
The letter really just asks Governor-elect DeSantis to acknowledge that climate change is a serious threat.
Florida State University student and intern with Environment Florida, Ashley Johnson, joined Moncrief. Johnson grew up near the Everglades and says she's seen firsthand the effects of climate change.
I had a lot of opportunities to enjoy the nature. And as the years went by, you slowly start to see the change in the enjoyment of where you're going, because you're seeing that animals are dying, some waters aren't suitable to go and swim in anymore, and these are waters that I've been swimming in since I can remember. So there is an emotional aspect to it, knowing that, you know, within my lifetime, and I'm only 22, that there's been so much change to the point that we can't even enjoy the nature that we grew up in.
During his campaign, DeSantis took a tour of the Everglades. He spoke with reporters afterward.
The sea rise may be because of human activity and the changing climate. You know, maybe it's not. I don't know. But what I do know is I see the sea rising. I see the increased flooding in South Florida. So I think you'd be a fool not to consider that an issue that we need to address.
Along with asking DeSantis to acknowledge climate change as a threat, the letter asks that he make polluters pay for cleanup, appoint scientists to water protection boards, and create a fund to support infrastructure investment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaise Gainey.
Still to come on Capitol Report, federal corruption indictments target a Tallahassee City Commissioner, but at least so far, not a single charge involves the mayor who ran for governor.
We have not seen Mayor Gillum's name involved in any of this yet. It's just something that we don't know what will happen next.
The Sunshine State continues its breakneck growth curve, and not everyone thinks that's necessarily a good thing.
I think obviously it's going to reduce the quality of life, because you're talking about more sprawling development, spending more time in cars.
We'll remember Florida's 41st governor, Joaquin Lawton Chiles.
I threw an elbow into Tom and I said, did he just utter a racial epithet?
And we'll pay tribute to a lawmaker who died before the midterm election and how her memory was honored in the Florida Senate this week.
What you probably didn't know about Dorothy is that she was a diva.
On Capitol Report, Regan McCarthy joins us. There was a lot of excitement in Florida's capital city this week, Regan, after many, many months, in fact, years of anticipation regarding an FBI investigation at Tallahassee City Hall. We finally got some federal indictments coming down. Tell us about that.
That's right. Tallahassee City Commissioner was charged with 44 counts of fraud, bribery, extortion. There was a 44-count indictment handed down this week. People say that Maddox was involved with extorting people who had business maybe going before the city commission. He is said to have been working with Paige Carter Smith, who's the director of the Downtown Improvement Authority. She actually just stepped down from that position in relation to this indictment. And they were using a shared business called Governance to sort of funnel people through, funnel money, bribes through, in order to, get Scott Maddox to allegedly sway the commission to vote in certain ways.
All right. Now, this is longtime Tallahassee City Commissioner Scott Maddox. In fact, he was the first elected mayor of the city of Tallahassee back in the 90s and subsequently came back, ran successfully for Tallahassee City Commission and got that position. What does this have to do, however, with the late gubernatorial election that we just covered, in which another Tallahassee City Commissioner, in fact, the mayor of Tallahassee, was the Democrat running for governor?
Right. So I'm sure lots of our listeners remember the discussion as Mayor Andrew Gillum was running for governor, or former Mayor Andrew Gillum was running for governor. And there was this discussion of this dark cloud over Tallahassee. There was lots of discussion about that he was under investigation with the FBI. Gillum said many times that he had not been named in any investigation and, in fact, claimed that he was not being investigated. Now, this indictment does not name Gillum at all. And so he is right in that part that he's not included in this indictment. But it did still impact, I think, his gubernatorial campaign because of this discussion about the black cloud of city hall corruption. I think it brought some questions to his campaign. It also uncovered that story that we all remember about Gillum's friendship with a lobbyist, Adam Corey, who was involved in getting some Hamilton tickets for Gillum. And there were questions about whether Gillum had received those from his brother or from this lobbyist, and whether he had appropriately paid for them or if it was not appropriate for him to accept them.
Well, Gillum not being named in this 44-count indictment, however, should not be misconstrued to say that the former mayor of Tallahassee may never, ever, ever be charged with anything, right?
Right. That's something we simply don't know. And I think that's very fair to say. He was not part of this indictment. We do not know what will happen going forward. We've been told from officials that whenever the FBI is involved in an investigation, it's very rare to get a heads up from them, you know, that the investigation is now complete. We're done and we've moved on with this. And so it's not typical that the FBI would inform us about what it is exactly that they're looking for or when they've stopped looking. And so we do know this has been coming down the pike here. We have been expecting that there was a possibility, there was a leak before, that Scott Maddox, the city commissioner, might be named in an indictment. And so this is not a complete surprise here. We have not seen Mayor Gillum's name involved in any of this yet. But as you point out, Tom, I mean, it's just something that we don't know what will happen next.
All we can say is watch this space. And given the fact that this is a federal investigation, it may very well be a long wait.
Yes, definitely.
Florida Public Radio's Regan McCarthy. Thanks so much, Regan.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Florida recently surpassed New York as the third most populous state in the country. By 2060, another 15 million people, nearly the population of the state today, are expected to move here. As part of a collaboration with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, WUSF's Steve Newborn takes a look at one part of the state that might be a preview of what the rest of Florida could become.
Looking from atop the ridge at U.S. Highway 27 as it follows the state's central spine, you could see brand new roofs rolling down the hills to Interstate 4. Downtown Orlando stands in the hazy distance beyond Epcot's iconic dome. Cars are everywhere. This is Four Corners, where Orange, Osceola, Polk, and Lake counties meet at the center of the state. It's home to Interstate 4, Florida's busiest cross-state highway, and Walt Disney World, where four theme parks average 50 million visitors a year. Mike Terrico has lived in Four Corners since he first started working for Disney when it opened in 1971.
It was basically palmettos and cow pastures and open area. The Four Corners area, within the last 10 years, explosive growth. This whole place out here is... it just exploded.
Fast forward 50 years, and Four Corners has become one of Florida's traffic choke points for both humans and wildlife. The area sits not only astride the main thoroughfare between the Tampa Bay area and Orlando, but it's in the middle of one of the few remaining green corridors used by wildlife migrating between the Everglades and the Green Swamp. 1,000 Friends of Florida, a nonprofit environmental advocacy group, said by 2060, another 15 million people are expected to move here. The I-4 corridor alone stands to double in population. Vivian Young is the group's communications director.
I think obviously it's going to reduce the quality of life because you're talking about more sprawling development, spending more time in cars, having water crises, which some parts of the state already are having.
Some environmentalists fear that migration pathways for wildlife could be cut off if local governments don't coordinate growth to protect the natural corridor. That's why the Florida Wildlife Corridor Expedition chose the Four Corners earlier this year to highlight the need to connect the remaining wild spaces before they're lost forever to development. Expedition founder and wildlife photographer Carlton Ward Jr. of Tampa.
It's going to be the anti-wildlife corridor if we don't put steps in place to protect it, because Interstate 4 is quickly becoming a dividing line, especially between Orlando and Tampa, that could cut the Everglades system off from the rest of our state and the rest of the country.
Four Corners is in part a victim of its location. It's far from the centers of power in all four counties, Orange, Osceola, Lake, and Polk. The Polk County seat, Bartow, is 40 miles away. Traffic congestion and rampant development has become so problematic here that civic and business leaders met on Halloween to start creating what they call a One Vision Plan. Longtime resident Terrico says this won't be the first plan.
About 10 years ago, there was a regional planning committee who did a study of Four Corners, put together a couple of elements, put them out, put them on paper, and they become dusty on a shelf.
And for people like Young of 1,000 Friends of Florida, that's only a beginning. Growth can't be stopped, she said, only managed. Florida's economy depends on tourism, which in turn depends on Florida being a beautiful destination.
At some point, is it going to reach a tipping point where people say the downside of all the congestion and sprawl is something that they don't want to deal with anymore?
That's the question Four Corners and the rest of Florida will have to answer. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
A 2016 Kauffman Foundation study found the Miami and Fort Lauderdale metro areas are hubs for immigrant high-tech entrepreneurs in particular, and immigrants are a big part of the workforce across industries in South Florida. This new campaign gives stickers to local businesses to post on their doors or walls. The red, white, and blue stickers read, "Immigrant Powered." Natalia Martinez-Cunanilla is the founder of the campaign, and she talked to WLRN's Nadege Green.
Walk me through what Immigrant Powered is and why you started it. Why now?
I noticed an absence in the conversation around the many long list of data points chronicling the economic impact of immigrants across our communities in the U.S. And so it felt that there was a disconnect between how we have a conversation about immigrant contributions in this country and how that gets featured. Think about a fourth of startups in the U.S. over the last decade have been founded by at least one immigrant founder, as an example. If you look at a completely different part of our labor force and you look at industries that experience chronic labor shortages, such as farming and agriculture, construction, there's an incredible amount of immigrants that are powering and making those sectors work. It tells a really rich story of how diverse and how different the contributions of immigrants to our labor force and our economic growth and prosperity are across completely different types of industries.
What does it mean to be immigrant powered?
If you are owned, founded, funded, staffed by immigrants, if none of you are immigrants, but you feel like your clients are immigrants, you serve immigrants in your community, really, however it is that you define yourself as immigrant powered, you're welcome to participate.
How many businesses have signed up so far? And what are businesses telling you about why they support this campaign?
Well, we have about 60 businesses signed up across South Florida. When people first submit a questionnaire for a sticker, you have to tell us kind of what makes your business immigrant powered? It's a very brief questionnaire, but that is one of the questions. And some of the comments that we've gotten there have been everything from, I'm not an immigrant, but my family immigrated here, and therefore I really consider my business immigrant powered. This really speaks to me. Or stories around, I was undocumented for 20 years, and then I started a business, and now I'm a business owner, and it feels really important to me to be able to tell that story.
You mentioned earlier that you know of at least one business where it sparked a conversation between a customer and a business owner. Can you share any of those specific examples?
Sure. I'm happy to share two. So one was a particular business owner that reported having some conversations with a handful of customers who didn't realize that they were immigrants just because they didn't have an accent. They kind of don't present, I guess, as what the stereotype of an immigrant would be. But you know, the owners of this particular restaurant are. And so it lending to some very interesting conversations in a wonderful way where their customers hadn't realized that they were immigrants and were inquiring around kind of what it means to be immigrant powered. The other example I had was a conversation I had personally with someone who kind of came across the sticker and asked more about it, and their concern was around, well, does this mean that people are in some way un-American, or are they aligning more with an immigrant identity, or kind of what does this mean? Is this in conflict with them being kind of tethered to this community? And it led to a really fascinating discussion around, well, what is more patriotic than, you know, contributing to your community, starting a business, running a business, working, supporting your family, investing in your own city, kind of what is, if that is not patriotic, kind of what is, I guess, is a little bit of a rhetorical question. And we ended on a really nice note, even though we kind of started out in a little bit of an interesting point of question.
That was Natalia Martinez Canalina, founder of Immigrant Powered, talking to WLRN reporter Nadege Green. Florida's 41st governor, Lawton Chiles, died this week 20 years ago. Sean Mulcahy looks back at one of Walken Lawton's most famous moments, the Hikun debate.
It was 1994. Lawton Chiles was Florida's governor, his popularity waning in a more conservative Florida than we know today. It was shaping up to be a tough year for Democrats nationally, and Chiles was embroiled in a fierce re-election battle against a sharp, young Republican politico with his eyes on the presidency. It appeared Jeb Bush had it in the bag as the two went into their final debate on November 1st. That is, until Chiles shocked Bush and the state with this now famous adage in his closing statement.
Well, my mama told me, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. But let me tell you one other thing about the old liberal. The old Hikun walks just before the light of day.
Bush stood there, stunned. And so did his communications director, Ron Sachs.
I was sitting next to Tom in the audience. This was the NBC stations out of Tampa, statewide. He had trained on all the tough issues where Jeb was representing a position that wasn't really all factual. And when he did the Hikun thing, it was the moment. It was the headline. I threw an elbow into Tom, and I said, did he just utter a racial epithet? You know, I mean, because it just, I never heard anything like that, and it was the moment.
But what is a Hikun? If it seems like Chiles was speaking another language, he was, in a way. He wasn't speaking to the Jeb Bushes. He was speaking to old-time rural Floridians. According to legend, the Hikun is the oldest, craftiest raccoon in the pack. While the younger raccoons go hunting in the middle of the night, the Hikun knows the best time is right before dawn. Chiles was making a final campaign message. He is the Hikun. A lifelong Floridian born at the start of the Great Depression, Chiles was raised in Lakeland. He first rose to fame when he made the thousand-mile trek from the Keys to Pensacola, earning him the nickname Walken Lawton. Chiles often joked he spoke cracker. He was a relic of a different era.
And what he did in that room was he got his righteous indignation up.
That's Chiles' son, Ed.
This young guy who doesn't know crap about Florida and, you know, hasn't been tested and, that, you know, it's coming on and things. And that's what that, you know, I think that's where the Hikun thing came out of.
Chiles made a final appeal to old Southern Democrats. He was still one of them. He would go on to score a come-from-behind victory. Chiles died in office at the end of his term in 1998 and is the last Democrat to hold the post. Every election cycle, the Hikun makes an appearance in headlines and political debate. It's become a piece of Florida lore. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the Florida Senate held a brief memorial service this week for the late Senator Dorothy Huckel. The Port Orange Republican died in early October, just days after abandoning her reelection bid because of an aggressive recurrence of cervical cancer. She was 72. Huckel served as Port Orange mayor for 4 years before being elected to the Florida House in 2004. She served in the House until she was elected to the Senate in 2012. As family and friends looked on, Huckel was remembered as an honest hard worker who was never late, loved Chinese food, and made close friends across the aisle. Gina Jordan put together this retrospective from senators who spoke in remembrance of their time with Dorothy Huckel.
Although she sat right behind me, she was my seatmate. And so members, new members especially, look around and see who's around you, because they will have an influence on you, just as Dorothy Huckel did on me on the floor. A reminder here, Bean, no, we're not on this one. No, next, Bean, you're up. I can still remember, and when I close my eyes, I can hear her voice, and it's like she's here.
People could not understand how Dorothy and I could possibly be friends. And that's because that's what we were, friends. We could have our debates with each other, little disagreement with each other, or she'll say, I can't believe you're going to vote for that. I said, I can't believe you're not going to vote for it.
But I knew how to turn her around if she was kind of down or down on me about something. But how's your son doing? And the subject would change, and she would light up.
What you probably didn't know about Dorothy is that she was a diva. And I called her Diva Dorothy.
It was a pleasure to work alongside her, and the very best thing I liked about her, she was a straight shooter. When she does like this and looks down over those glasses, she doesn't even have to say it. I mean, it's like, boom, I like that, I didn't like that.
We now have a conference room on the fourth floor. And this is a large conference room for many people to, for senators to bring their constituents into in large numbers. Those folks that want to come up from the districts and visit with us. And it's a way for us to hear from them and make them feel welcome, as Senator Dorothy Huckel would. And I would like to announce to you all first, for family and friends, and I guess simultaneously the Senate, that that conference room will be named the Senator Dorothy L. Huckel Conference Room.
I will miss her. I already miss her tremendously. And so, Godspeed, my diva friend.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.